Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way we think about and experience our world. Today is June 2nd, 2017, if you're listening live. And if you're not listening live, I would just say thank you for coming to find this encore or for picking it up in the archives. I so appreciate that, and I hope you'll hear something that is really enriching to you by doing that. Now, on today's show, we will be discussing A Course in Miracles with writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. Now, our focus comes directly out of the Course in Miracles manual for teachers. And we are looking at sort of the beginning section where it talks about the characteristics of God's teachers. Now, this is a conversation we started 2 weeks ago because we decided we wanted to focus on the very first characteristic, which is listed as trust. Now, of course, there's a whole lot of them. I think there's at least 10 of them in there and all really worthy material to focus on. I mean, it kind of makes me think sometimes when you've got your focus in it, do you really want to focus on fear? Do you really want to focus on those things that scare you or make you upset? Or do you just want to focus on something that feels good? Well, when you read the description of these, they do. That's how they feel. You know, it's about honesty and gentleness and joy and defenselessness and open-mindedness. Now, of course, that being said, it doesn't keep me from, watching some horror shows or from reading some books that scare me, because I guess I still like those things too. But this is a list, and these are some things to focus on that I think really will uplift us and enrich our lives. So we're going to continue that conversation about trust. But just like I did 2 weeks ago when we started this conversation, I want to clarify a couple of things right up front, especially for those of you who may not I've heard that conversation, and just because I think it's so necessary. I mean, in A Course in Miracles, there's so much repetition. But one of them is teacher of God. That's kind of a phrase that can really, you know, throw people, or this whole idea that we're going to the manual for teachers. You know, in most school systems in the world's eyes, usually if you're talking about a manual for teachers, you're talking about somebody who's learned something and now they're teaching it to other people. Well, in A Course in Miracles, they consider all of us teachers of God, or at least we're all teachers. Let's put it that way, because all the time, 24/7, we are teaching what we believe to be true. So if we believe in poverty, if we believe in scarcity, if we believe in pain, if we believe in the goodness, you know, whatever it is that we truly believe, that's what we're demonstrating and that's what we're teaching. We're teaching it to ourselves and we're teaching it to everybody else. So when they talk about teachers, that's what they're talking about. So specifically when they say teachers of God, they're kind of also referring to people who've made a choice and said, you know what? There are two voices to listen to. There's the ego. And there is what we would call God or, you know, the Holy Spirit or Jesus or a divine, you know, essence of some sort, whatever name you want to give it. There's two choices. And if you are listening to the choice that's not the ego, then that would be kind of the teacher of God. You're choosing for that. The other thing they talk about is, and just remember, there's always that distinction between the ego and God, kind of a dichotomy there. Even though the Course in Miracles would teach us nothing exists outside of God. We made up all the rest of it. But the other thing I want to kind of stress today is because we're talking about the steps to developing trust. That's what this section talks about. It says there's 6 steps. But once again, in our minds, we like to think of it as very, very sequential. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I mastered level 1. I mastered level 2. But you know what? It doesn't work that way. In fact, Ken Wapnick, who is a very renowned teacher, says the steps are not literal, they're not sequential, and they're not linear. Meaning, you know, we kind of learn one and we kind of move on to the second, but you know what? Then we're right back at number 1. Or maybe we're on number 3 and we step back to number 2. It's not quite the same. He talks about it as, it's not the same as walking into a room and closing the door and being in a totally new space. We kind of dance back and forth until we finally get it. So there are 6 stages. Maybe we'd see it that way. There's 6 stages and we kind of dance back and forth between them depending on where we're at. And I can tell you from personal experience, that's so true. In fact, in these steps, you know, there's one, you know, you kind of get, you go, okay, I got it. Well, that's a very step that they call that you're not settled anymore. And that's it. All of a sudden you realize, is this all there is? Oh my God, I'm not as high as I thought, or I'm not as good as I thought. I thought I had this mastered. And that's when we realize we don't have it mastered at all. You know, there's always more. And, you know, how many times have you come to that point in your life? So don't see it as, okay, I mastered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. We, you know, and by the time we master 6, by the time we really get there, then we don't have too much more purpose for an ego at that point. So in any case, those are my opening remarks. And with that, there's only one more thing I want to do, and that is to invite you to come and meet us over on Facebook. We do have a private group over there that you can join. You can make comments. You can ask questions during the show, and you can participate that way. Most of you know how to get over there. But if you don't, and maybe you're new to the show today, maybe you're new to 1-2 Radio, welcome. I'm so glad that you found us. But the way that you can find that room is by going to our regular website, which is 1-2radio.com. And when you do that, you will see a link that says chat. And when you click it, then you're automatically redirected over to Facebook. And our producer, Scott, will actually let you come into the room. And he just, you know, does his little magic, pushes a few buttons or whatever, and he'll watch for that. So if you're knocking on the door, he's going to open up that door for you. So come on over and join all the people who are already there. And thank you, Alicia and Greg. It's always great to see you guys there. And Elizabeth and Renee and Mercy and Jan and Liliana and Jody. Thank you so much for being there already in the room. So I now want to just welcome Bruce. So, Bruce, I kind of hear you laughing or snickering in the background. So, welcome.
Thanks, T.A. Always a joy to converse and with you and be on your program. And, I just some of the things reminded me of, you know, the humor really that's in this curriculum, and that we can afford to laugh. And anyway, your opening remarks were brilliant and just so right on the mark. All the things that I thought I was, you know, needed saying, you said and eloquently. So thank you.
Well, they bear repeating. I mean, that's why. In fact, as I read this material, I love reading also Ken's version. And when I say Ken's version, you know, of course, we've talked about that before, too. He actually wrote what you would consider maybe a commentary. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even going to call it Cliff Notes, because what I think is kind of funny about Ken's is it's much, much longer than the original material.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And pages and pages. But, you know, we need that sometimes because it's mm-hmm. so easy to take something out of context. Exactly. But Ken Wapnick literally wrote commentaries on the text and on the lessons and also on the manual for teachers. And so I like reading what he has to say about it. But even as he does, just every time he just keeps going back to it, you know. The purpose is this. The purpose is this. And so, you know, we love to get all, I think, lost in the maze. At least I do. And then he always brings it right back. Nope, this is the purpose. This is what's going on here, you know. So I love reading Ken's version of it, too.
They are brilliant. Yeah, and for anybody who's not familiar with those, the books that C.A. is referring to are called the Journey Through series. There's the Journey Through the Text, Journey Through the Workbook, and Journey Through the Manual for teachers. And they're all just brilliant. I'm actually in a study group on Monday nights. I've read the workbook and the manual commentaries, those two Journey Through books. I'm just now getting into the second volume of the four volumes of the Journey Through the Text, only because I thought it'd be fun to go through it together with a study group that I attend online on Monday nights. And we took, I think 2.5 years to go through the first volume because there's so much in there. And we figured, hey, well, if it takes us 10 years to go through the four volumes at that rate, why not? You know, it's not a big deal because, you know, what's the hurry, you know?
That's right. Time is an illusion.
Exactly. Yeah. But, so, and at the same time, why wait for heaven as you so eloquently remind? And that's always a good thing to remember too.
Yes.
Should we go through and kind of to recap the first stage, just so you say, it's not linear, sequential, or even you know, in any way that we normally think of it. There a lot of these happen at once, all at once, and or at different times and out of sequence. So
right, exactly, yeah.
But they're all things that we ultimately address in one capacity or another as decision making minds, remembering that we never left spirit. Yeah,
right. So where do you want to start? Go ahead.
Should we read the first one just as a recap before?
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea.
Okay. I'll go ahead and read that one. So this is the section called The Development of Trust, which is a subsection, although it has 10 sections on what are the characteristics of God's teachers, and the first one being trust, and then the first subsection of that is the development of trust. And within that, this sort of nested hierarchy, the first one says, first, they must go through what might be called a period of undoing. This need not be painful, but it usually is so experienced. It seems as if things are being taken away, and it's rarely understood that their lack of value is merely being recognized. How can lack of value be perceived unless the perceiver is in a position where he must see things in a different light? He is not yet at a point at which he can make the shift entirely internally. And so the plan will sometimes call for changes in what seem to be external circumstances. These changes are always helpful. When the teacher of God has learned that much, he goes on to the second stage. So I think this is it's just sort of the initial realization that the things that we've valued in the world as being our interpretations, really, of things, which are really where the source of the pain comes from, that's being talked about here. Those interpretations, when we latch onto those things and the white knuckled grip on the steering wheel, so to speak, of ego's vehicle for madness, gets us inevitably into trouble, or what appears to be trouble, because we think that there's value in our interpretation, of things that are happening in the world that really are, just opportunities for us to look at the contents of our minds. So, that's again an opportunity to just see things differently. I could see peace instead of the interpretation that ego puts forth.
Right. And I think there's several things in here that are just so important, partially because they are repeated throughout A Course in Miracles, but this idea of undoing is so vital. Because once again, in the world, we always think of adding. I'm going to add this. I'm going to add more clothes to my wardrobe, more shoes, more furniture, more CDs to my collection, more electronic gadgets. We're always adding things. And in this, it's like, no, it's undoing. Unloading, peeling away the layers to see what's there. And that's not something that I think we're very used to. We're used to always thinking about going forward, but this is always about undoing something that is a mistake. So in the same way, it might be like weeding a garden, taking out the ideas that aren't useful, taking out the things that aren't useful. And also, I love this where it says, it seems as if things are being taken away, but what's really happening is that we're recognizing their lack of value.
Yes.
And that can be daunting too, because even though this may not be the best example, I'm thinking, I was saying something to somebody the other day about, how you'll watch a series, like specifically we're talking about Twin Peaks. And I remember when I saw that, it was a series in the 90s. Oh, my God, that was just like the most far out, crazy, unbelievable thing that just it was thrilling because you never knew what was going to come next. But I said, I wonder if I rewatched it, whether or not I'd have that same feeling, or would it just be, it doesn't have that punch. And I think about that in terms of, there are things from our past, whether it's from childhood or adolescence or whatever, and we want it to carry the same punch, the same joy, the same feeling, and it just doesn't. And that can be kind of upsetting too when all of a sudden we realize something that just used to have so much value for us, so much joy, we try to repeat the experience and it just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so it is, that's why it does feel like we're losing things sometimes. If we recognize that it just doesn't have the value for us. And this, on a spiritual level, that's what happens. All this stuff we want to put all this emotional energy into and how important it is, and all of a sudden it's just like it just doesn't have the same value anymore. But that's not the same as feeling, oh, I'm losing things. You're only losing them because you don't care about them anymore.
Exactly. And I think the important thing is we've actually chosen a substitute by investing our identity in a world of insane illusion. And, mm-hmm. and when we recognize that that has no value, it's only because we've seen that what lies beyond that, beyond the special love and special hate, as the Course talks about it, which is really using specifics in a world of duality to keep us blindsided and you know, essentially not focused on what really is the underlying truth behind it. When we see that that doesn't work for us, the only way we're going to want to shift to something that is lasting is by having that lasting, eternal, truth that we really are, and we all are, be of value to us. And we have to it's an experiential thing. I don't think anybody can do it for anyone else. We can't, you know, no matter how hard we try to brute force it, it only happens when we're each of us ready to recognize that there's something beyond, as one of the workbook lessons says, beyond this world, there's a world that I want. And that's the world, of connection, of relationship, of inclusion that is really the reflection, if you will, of the oneness that we all are and have in truth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think this first paragraph reminds us that we need to generalize too. And then I think that the next one that we're about to go into also says that, you know, eventually we start to, you know, see that there's more and more things don't have the value that they used to, or the interest, because we found, something that really does have lasting value. And the lasting value again is those shared interests. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Yeah, but before I do, I want to kind of stop on something that you said, because it's such an important concept, and that's the concept of generalization.
Mm-hmm.
Because they talk about that a lot in the text, or at least throughout the course, is that's it. In our, you know, in our specific lives, we have specific lessons. But each of those lessons can then, we can literally go, oh, well, if this applies to this, then maybe it applies over here too. And that's a very important concept. It's not like we have to take every single thing in our life and re-examine it and redo it. It's as if we can generalize from one situation, and it can then cover a whole lot of other situations at the same time. But I think that's an experiential thing. It's almost difficult to talk about it, but we do that all the time in our lives. I mean, because that is how we learn, you know,
yeah.
even in the world's level, that is how we learn to walk and talk and everything else. We, you know, we generalize from one situation and assume the next one is going to be somewhat similar. So because of that, when we can forgive, when we can literally forgive one person or one situation, or when we can find peace even in one moment by literally turning within and saying there must be another way to see this, then whether we're happy or sad or whatever the emotion is, we somehow know that the next time we can do that same thing, that that's always available. We can generalize that. So thank you for bringing up that word. I thought it was important. So.
Yeah. And to further bounce on, on what you just said, the idea of generalizing, I think is crucial, and it really only works when what we're basing and founding, you know, the foundation of that generalization is based on something that doesn't change. And
right.
I think that's what attracted me years ago to what's become known as sacred geometry, and probably you do astrology and other things. Things that either don't change or are very slow to change is kind of leading up to things that never change. Certainly, you know, the planets have been around a long time in our solar system. But the things that are eternal are things that you can count on no matter what the weather is, what gender or political party or what circumstance you might be in, what time or place, you know, it doesn't depend on geography or social status or any of that kind of stuff. It has nothing to do with your economic situation or anything that happens to be in your life story. If you can find things that are true, that you can count on, that's become a bedrock in your mind, then you have a basis for generalization. And what A Course in Miracles, I think, really inexorably leads us back to and over again is the idea that we are that, not as the seemingly separate selves that we think we are, but in truth as the spirit that is watching the shenanigans of our egos and seeing with amusement that that isn't really getting us the peace that we want, the unchanging peace. And then we begin to generalize when we realize, oh, there is a voice within us, if you will, metaphorically, that does speak for that peace. And that's the one to trust. And that's why we need to learn to trust that more and more. And that's why the generalization, I think, is such an important part of that.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it feeds right into that whole idea of you had talked about inclusion or exclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, at first we think, oh, I can forgive this situation. Or, yes, if I turn inward to my inner teacher, they can help with this. But, oh, no, not that. That's different. And that's where we start to realize there is no hierarchy of illusion, because the inner voice, the inner teacher, can help us with any illusion. And that becomes a generalization. It's like, because I think we always, I mean, I know I still do that. I'm going to forgive this thing, but not that. That's unforgivable. That doesn't apply. And sooner or later you realize, but you know what? It did work in that other situation. Even though I don't know how it worked, I know that when I turned inward and said, okay, my life is in chaos, or I feel in chaos, I'm upset, that I got some relief from that. I felt different, even though I didn't know how it happened. I mean, at least that's the way it is for me. Mm-hmm, I don't know how it happens. It's not as if logically I logic something out and then decide that somebody deserves to be forgiven. It doesn't happen that way. I mean, you know, I want it to, but it doesn't happen that way. And so then the more often I have that experience, I go, okay, well, let's try it and see if it works with this one. You know, let's see if this situation is as amenable as the other one, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can learn to apply the true forgiveness that the Course talks about that's not based on any particulars. And then that bypasses the, what is also referred to in the Course as the forgiveness to destroy, which is basically the something bad happened. And it was at the hands of someone else or something else that I've been victimized. And so using my great, effort, I'll be big enough to forgive this horrendous, slight that's been, affected upon me kind of thing. And, you know, which really is basically just another form of victimhood and martyrdom.
Yes.
And I think that's why the idea of forgiveness is such a challenging concept, because that's the kind of forgiveness that most people think of. And so to generalize the true forgiveness, to realize that, okay, if I can, like you're saying, if I can remember that I've had an experience once in a long while, and make them more and more frequent, that I can start to see that the times that I didn't base that release in my mind on something happening as being fact, if I make the situation real by making my identity attached to it and my peace attached to it, then forgiveness becomes impossible basically, and that can't be generalized. But if I can look beyond that, if you will, look through it, that then gives me an opportunity to see that, wow, nothing really happened in truth, because the eternal self that I am and that is also identical to this other person or all these other circumstances has not been affected by that. And I think it takes a lot of practice to do that, and the trust. I think that's where the trust comes in. One more visual that comes to mind is in the generalization is sometimes I think it's for me helpful to picture like the branches of a tree, they're starting with a thick trunk and then the larger branches and then the smaller branches, each one branching off. And I think we have these experiences that are kind of like little isolated leaves, and then pretty soon a couple of leaves that are close together, maybe in terms of our economic situation. We say, oh, wow, I managed to not be upset about this financial setback or this unexpected expense. And it's not that you don't, you know, respond in the world appropriately, but you don't let it ruin your whole day or your whole year or whatever. And then you say, oh, I did that a year ago. I could do that again. And then, so it's kind of like two leaves then coming together on the common stem. And then pretty soon, you know, follow enough of those together, and then it becomes a strength of mind that then can be generalized in other areas. Like maybe there's a relationship branch, a major branch, and you found that you could, forgive yourself for investing in a condemnation or an imagined hurt in one situation that then becomes an opportunity to apply it to a similar situation. And then that's like two more leaves on a different branch coming together. And then pretty soon, you know, you start seeing, wow, I could apply this to the whole tree.
Right.
And then eventually it takes it back down to the trunk and the roots, and it's the whole thing has changed ultimately.
Yeah. That's a very good analogy. Thank you for that. Okay, so I will read the next section. So step two or stage two. Next, the teacher of God must go through a period of sorting out. This is always somewhat difficult because having learned that the changes in his life are always helpful, he must now decide all things on the basis of whether they increase the helpfulness or hamper it. He will find that many, if not most of the things he valued before, will merely hinder his ability to transfer what he has learned to new situations as they arise. Because he has valued what is really valueless, he will not generalize the lesson for fear of loss and sacrifice. It takes great learning to understand that all things, events, encounters, and circumstances are helpful. It is only to the extent to which they are helpful that any degree of reality should be accorded them in this world of illusion. The word value can apply to nothing else.
Wow.
Yeah.
Says a lot there, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But, you know, once again, we know what this feels like. You know, we do sort through our lives all the time. This works, this doesn't. This works, this doesn't. But one of the really good take home messages, I think, in this section is to realize that everything can be our lesson. Everything can be a teaching opportunity for us. You know, we don't have to say, oh, that was totally without value. I mean, and I'm using value in another way, just that we can. And I like that whole idea, too, of it's pretty easy. Is this helpful or not? Does this help me remember who I am? Does this help me find greater peace of mind? Or does it hinder it? Which way?
Exactly.
It's pretty black and white.
Yeah, that criterion of the feeling of peace is really, for me, again, the bottom line as well. And I think that's what you're alluding to there, because that's it, isn't it? I mean, if we're peaceful, then it's helpful. And if it leads away from that interpretation, then it's a pretty sure bet that we're listening to an ego motivated, a fearful interpretation of things that is not making us happy.
Right.
Another thing that comes to mind is, which I think parallels what you just said, is something that Ken Wapnick is fairly emphatic about in a very gentle way, of course, as this whole materialist, that if you pay attention, you'll notice that in A Course in Miracles, the word every, all, and none, and those kind of superlatives appear many, many places throughout all three volumes of the Course. And I think that the reason for that is that this is a course in pure non-duality. And in order for us to see the contrast between what has always been and what has never been, you know, we vacillate back and forth. And that's part of this process of learning to generalize, is to see how much we vacillate, see how much resistance we have, see how much we bounce back and forth between the two thought systems of peace and the absence of it, which is sort of like, you know, the idea that black is not a color, it's the absence of color. And I think that's a good metaphor for the ego. It's basically the darkness of the ego is really just the lack of our willingness to embrace the light that we've always been, because we made up darkness. And because it's a not invented here kind of a thing, it's like, well, I made this up, it must be cool, you know.
Right. And it must be real.
it must be real. Exactly. But I think A Course in Miracles, and A Course in Miracles, I think would suggest that anything involving space and time ultimately is part of that desolation or that darkness. But that doesn't mean we need to condemn it. We just need to look at it. And I think that's, again, another emphasis that Ken has in his work that is so helpful. Speaking of helpful, is that all we need to do is look, but the looking has to be done, you know, metaphorically holding the hand of our inner kindness teacher, or Jesus, of course, or the Holy Spirit, however you want to refer to that awareness that we took with us into the dream. And that awareness then gives us the strength and the compassion and the insight, which fits perfectly with all these 10 characteristics that we're reading about, to look at things differently and to generalize. So.
Yes. Yeah. Which, you know, we say this all the time, but this is what it really comes down to. You know, even like the logical part of me goes, okay, there's 6 steps. Let me get these down. But you know what? That's not what it's about. What it really is about is every single moment that you can remember that you've got a choice, that you are a decision maker. And are you going to listen to the voice of the ego, or are you going to go to the inner guide and teacher? Because you can face anything. You can deal with anything. You can reframe, reinterpret anything based on which teacher you're going with. Like you say, you know, grabbing the hand, holding the hand of that inner teacher. And that's the only thing we ever really need to remember. You know, let's say we go away and go, okay, I can't remember the 6 steps, you know, and in fact, Ken even says, don't worry about what step you think you're in or phase you're in. That's not the point. Don't go, okay, well, Bruce is on step 4 and I'm on step 2. You know, that's the ego talking. It loves the dichotomy. It loves those strict little, you know, that hierarchy. And that's not what it's about. Right. Every single moment, it's simply about who am I listening to? What teacher am I listening to? And if I feel peaceful, then I know the answer. And if I don't, I know the answer.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a simple test, isn't it?
Yes.
A very, very, very simple test. It's not easy, but it's simple.
That's right. That's right. But I just want to keep emphasizing that because, and I know I'm projecting here because that's me. You know, you show me a step-by-step protocol and I can follow it. And I can write that step-by-step protocol too. You know, I love that. Just show me what to do. You know, just show me how to become perfect. Just show me what to do. And this is like, it always just keeps coming back to those 2 decisions, or that one decision rather. One choice, one decision. Who are you going to listen to? Because as you listen, you will then make other decisions, other choices, or at least what appears to be other choices and decisions, you know. There again, it's all an illusion. So, you know, we have our own mazes and for whatever reason. So should we go on to stage 3?
Sure. Yeah, I was just going to comment that somehow what you were saying was reminding me of something I heard years ago about it's just those little moment to moment decisions that have a cumulative effect. But every moment really is pivotal in a, in a sense that. You know, one decision can make a huge difference. And the quote that comes to mind is something about it, like somebody from NASA, I think, might have said that, you know, right at launch, the thickness of a dime in certain parameters can make the difference between, you know, a rocket going to planet A or planet B.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's basically, yes. I mean, there really is that level of impact, sort of like the you know, a butterfly's wings can start a hurricane on the other side of the planet, that kind of interconnectedness thing. And yet, in truth, you know, no butterflies or hurricanes or rockets or planets were harmed in the making of this dream, because all these things are ultimately a projection of our minds that are, again, back to that two choices, you know, or, you know, one choice of between 2 thought systems. And that is, you know, if we can remember that we have a teacher of peace and a teacher of discord and discomfort. And we are constantly choosing between those 2 moment to moment. That really is that thickness of a dime. It's just a subtle thing, but boy, it makes all the difference in the world. In terms of how we feel, especially if we apply this consistently, which is why this is certainly a curriculum that recognizes wholeheartedly the importance of practice.
And, right.
You know, I'm also reminded of one of the I think it's in Absence from Felicity where Ken is talking, Kenneth Wapnick is talking about Helen's, feedback or kickback, I guess you could say, to Jesus saying, you know, this is so difficult. And the comment was, well, and this is also in the text somewhere, I think, maybe you remember where, but, you know, have you considered actually, I'm paraphrasing greatly, have you considered actually trying what
trying
what it suggested. And that's it, is because we fight this tooth and nail, and being, you know, aware of the resistance that ego mounts and the defenses that it marshals to try to preserve its fake identity. If we keep that in mind, then we're not so blindsided, and we, you know, anticipate that and say, oh, there it is again. And that way we don't make those little sabotage attempts a big deal. And therefore they're either, you know, contained more quickly because we're not making a big deal out of them, or we don't even go there, you know, at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the generalization kicks in, is after a while we say, ah, there it is. That's not what I want. And we just, you know, drop it, you know, just like a dog holding a toy, you know, a stick or a toy or something. Is it, we learn.
Yeah.
It, but yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you're so right. Cause how often do we fight something? And then it's like, well, have you ever tried it?
You know,
have you ever actually tried it? No. And you know, I heard a joke when I was a child, and I may have told it to you before, but I always think of it in terms, well, I mean, I've used it kind of as a life lesson, but certainly with A Course in Miracles. And that is, there's a golfer on a golf course and he slices a shot really badly, meaning for you non-golfers, that means it goes off, I think specifically to the right, but anyway, it goes totally haywire instead of going down the fairway. And the ball then, and I don't remember the details, but basically the ball bounces it and it hits a car and the windshield breaks and the driver then goes into another car and then that driver goes into a tree and knocks down a tree and, you know, just this sequence of events.
Uh-huh.
And so as somebody catches up with the golfer and says, what are you going to do about this? He says, I'm going to adjust my grip a little bit.
That's good. I haven't heard that one. That's a great joke.
Yeah. And like I said, I heard that as a child. My parents were golfers. And so, of course, they thought it was hilarious. But what I got from it is how often we do that. And I think, once again, in A Course, we're reminded we're always trying to fix the world. We're trying to fix all these circumstances. And I'm not saying, by the way, that we should be irresponsible, but
right,
we're trying to fix all these circumstances when, in truth, the golfer had it right. The only way he could have changed what happened was to adjust his grip.
Uh-huh. The cause, not the effect.
Yeah. Right, exactly, the cause. He couldn't have changed all those sequence of events. But, as you said, like the skinny dime could make the difference. The adjustment in the grip made all the difference in the world, all the sequence of events that happened afterwards. And I just think that I personally, give me one of the symptomatic things, and I want to attack that rather than ever going for the cause. Don't ask me to actually change my mind. You know, don't ask me to go back to the cause of something, but that's the only place you're ever going to make a significant difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And we have so many opportunities to get all up in arms about the latest news update from, let's say, just randomly Washington or some other part of the planet, and think, oh gosh, you know, now what are we going to do? Kind of thing. Well, the only thing to do really is, as you just pointed out, CA, is to make that choice in the mind for a thought system that includes everyone's welfare, which is really what this curriculum is about. And that welfare ultimately is about recognizing that we're all spirit, we're all one being, we're all one thing. We never left our source. And from that perspective, we can afford to forgive the dream of all the differences and all the space-time dramas that appear to be going on. And ironically, it gives us the most latitude and the most range of options, the largest toolkit from which to draw to do things within the world if we feel so inspired as a result of that, the real inspiration, to act upon that and you know, quote-unquote, make a difference in the world, recognizing, of course, that if the world is where our peace comes from, then we're barking up the wrong tree again. But if we have peace as a foundation, then we can afford to do what can be the most helpful thing within the context of how, you know, we see the world. Because we're not constrained by thinking in terms of, well, the what's in it for me thing that is going to limit our choices dramatically.
Right. Well, and I was thinking, and I'm kind of jumping ahead, because Ken wrote this about stage four, actually, which is the period of settling down, which comes after the period of relinquishment. Okay. But it kind of ties into what you were just saying. And Ken says, you know, this involves a realization that we feel better when we let go of the ego, which means letting go of our victimization history and attitude of finding fault with everyone and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I just thought, see, once again, the Course and Ken just has a way of putting it all in perspective. You know, yes, what the ego is? We say ego, it's, you know, oh, what's that? Well, that's our victim story. And so can we let go of our own victim story? Poor me, poor me. And can we let go of the attitude that there must be something wrong and there's whoever is at fault is everyone and everything? Because how many, I mean, I just know for me, how often during my day is that what I'm doing? I'm fault finding.
Sure.
You know, if you didn't do this, this wouldn't have happened. If that hadn't gone that way, this wouldn't have happened. And I thought, you know, so could we boil it down even today and just remember that? That's our ego story. I'm a victim and everybody else is at fault. And so in some ways he goes, that's all you have to let go of. But it's like, that's everything to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Another metaphor that came to mind, which I thought about before we started the conversation this morning, and now you reminded me of somehow, is the image of Mr. Magoo in the old cartoon where he's on a construction site and there's this skyscraper being built and just the girders and that, you know, that kind of three-dimensional structure is there, and he somehow manages to and he's blind, of course, and that's for people that have never
don't
seen
know
it
who
or,
Mr.
or,
Magoo
or,
is.
Or too, you know, too young to remember it. Anyway, he walks up this ramp and then he finds himself walking, you know, several stories up, presumably on these girders, not realizing the quote danger unquote of this. He's oblivious to all that. But, and miraculously, just when he's about to walk off into empty space, another Derek has swung another girder around that just happens to align with his next step. He walks across that girder and then is the girder is then dropping this, the big machinery is dropping mm-hmm. the girder down to the ground and he walks off totally oblivious to the fact that he'd been several stories in the air and just about walked into empty space, you know. But I think that's kind of, I think a humorous metaphor for how we're all, you know, blindly navigating through this world because we think we understand it, because we think it's real. I'm reminded of the first introduction to chapter 21 where it says your cues for inference are wrong. That one phrase says so much to me that it's like, okay, if we based our peace of mind and our identity and our reality on our cues from the world, then yeah, we're gonna be just walking around like Mr. Magoo and
right.
and not really have a clue as to what's really going on because we're basing it on a projection of a dream, you know.
Yes, and you know, and that's the Magoo is a perfect example of it because when we can step back and really see it, that's exactly what we'd realize we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we were blind there. It's, oh my God, I thought that was true, or I thought that was real. I thought that's how that was going to work out. And yet we always think we know in the moment, don't we?
We sure do. And I think that's where the humility comes in, which is another characteristic, that I don't, is that one of the 10? It certainly ties into it if it's not anyway, but I think that actually, you know, cause when we realize that we don't have, as seemingly separate selves, the big picture, there's no way we could have that. And then that is why trust is so important because there is, if you will, a metaphoric voice within us that does have that. And we all share that and we all have access to that 24/7, 365. And that's what we're learning to trust more and more and to generalize.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think we have time to go through at least one more stage.
Oh, sure.
So
let's do it.
We've gone through a period of undoing, the period of sorting out, and now it's the period of relinquishment. Do you want to read that section?
Sure. The third stage through which the teacher of God must go can be called, quote, a period of relinquishment, unquote. If this is interpreted as giving up the desirable, it will engender enormous conflict. Few teachers of God escape this distress entirely. And again, that's, You know, I'm gonna pause just for a moment and read and touch into something that's in Bob Rosenthal's book, which is From Plagues to Miracles. I just finished reading that a few weeks ago, and I've been talking to him on other recorded conversations on ACIM blog, which you can check out if anybody's interested. But he in this book does a brilliant job of using the parable of Exodus and the Hebrews, you know, having escaped the metaphoric ego of the Pharaoh, and as he puts out in this book, as a metaphor, and now after crossing the Red Sea, we've sort of kind of at some point, which it kind of ties into this development of trust. At some point, we you know, not in a mathematical way necessarily, but we sort of have a predominant emphasis on Holy Spirit as an identity rather than ego, but we're still kind of in the wilderness. And we have to trust on a daily basis that we're going to get our manna from heaven. As he points out, that's sort of like, you know, trusting that the holy instance will come to us and that we will have what we need when we need it. And I think that's recognizing that hanging on to the things, and I'm reminding myself of having moved twice this last year, in a literal sense, you know, all the stuff that you take in a moving van, it's just a great metaphor for looking at the contents of the mind. and it's not about the form, because, you know, it doesn't really matter how much stuff a person has or doesn't have, but it's the mental baggage that really is being addressed here, of course.
Right.
And realizing that what's really desirable is the peace. But the things that we think bring us peace become the baggage, because we can be attached to so many things. So anyway, I'll continue the paragraph unless you want to comment on that so far.
No, good, but that was very good. Thank you. Okay. I mean, because absolutely, isn't that what it is? It's that attachment. It's not what it is.
Exactly.
It's the attachment of it.
It's the mind's belief that something in a hologram is going to make us happy or not.
Right, because if I have it, I'm happy. But if it's vulnerable, if somebody takes it away, then I'm not happy.
Exactly. It's a conditional, a dream of conditionality that we're learning to let go of.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, the Course is a uncompromising, pure, non-dual thought system saying that truth is true and only truth is true. and that really is a tremendous hope for us, because if that is correct, don't reuse the word true, then that means we really all are able to get back to where we never left. And in fact, the Course even tells us we never did leave. So it's a done deal. We just have to remember it. So anyway, it goes on. Few teachers of God can escape this distress entirely. There is, however, no point in sorting out the valuable from the valueless unless the next obvious step is taken. Therefore, the period of overlap is apt to be one in which the teacher of God feels called upon to sacrifice his own best interests on behalf of truth. He has not yet realized as yet how wholly impossible such a demand would be. Now, of course, this depends on which self we are identifying with. Is it the seemingly separate self, the lowercase s self, or is it the true self? Because the true self obviously can't make any sacrifices, being everything.
Right.
Okay. He can learn this only as he actually does give up the valueless. Through this, he learns that where he anticipated grief, he finds a happy lightheartedness instead. Where he thought something was asked of him, he finds a gift bestowed on him. And as so many paragraphs and sections of A Course in Miracles typify, this one, again, following suit, starts with the examples of the ego's conflicted thought system and shows that when we relinquish that, there's a peace and you know, the contrast between the fearful, guilty, sinful, morbid thought system of the ego, which is just pure desolation, is not true. And the dark bleakness of that really is contrasted by the brilliant, gentle peacefulness of the light that we all are. And that whole point of this curriculum seems to be to show us in such tremendous, consistent contrast that at some point we just say, okay, I get it. The difference is obvious between those two thought systems. How could I possibly want to dabble in this one that I made up that is not serving me. So.
Right. That just continually disappoints us.
Exactly.
You know, continually disappoints us.
Just like Charlie Brown and the football that Lucy sets out for him to kick every year. And he knows he's going to, you know, have the football pulled away at the last moment and land on the ground with a whump on his back, you know, and that's the sound that you usually see in the cartoon, whump. And, but we keep doing it over and over again because we haven't generalized. We haven't learned that, you know, going down the road of fault finding and condemning and getting all upset about a reality that we made up isn't working out for us so well.
That's right. And, you know, I'd also like to emphasize, because it's, you know, somewhere in this particular step, it seemed embedded. And if it wasn't, I'm still going to say it is. And that is, it's the experience of it. In other words,
yes.
You can listen to this show. You can read through these steps. You can read A Course in Miracles, but you've got to experience it, which is very much what the workbook is about. You know, doing the workbook lessons, because we're never going to get it intellectually. It's a feeling, you know, it's a gut level experience of going through that and recognizing, you know what, this isn't making me happy. This isn't helpful. This is always a disappointment. And just saying, okay, so what do I need to know about this situation? We've got to experience it. And once again, I'm projecting. I don't want to. I just want to read about it. I want you to lecture. I want you to tell me about it. And then I just want to get it magically. But you know what? It doesn't happen that way. We go through the experience, but we can also go through the experience and actually be joyful going, that's what this is about. That, you know, it should be a joyful experience to go, I now recognize that doesn't have value to me. Mm-hmm. You know, why do I want to hold on to it? Why do I want to continue to be attached when it's not bringing me joy, when it's only hindering my ability to be spontaneous? So, you know, but we've got to experience it is all I'm saying. So whether you're experiencing it and you're going through the conflict that they're talking about in these steps, that's a good thing. Go mm-hmm. through the conflict.
Exactly. And I think what happens as we do that, we start to look objectively at our mental identity portfolio, if you will, and realize that all the things that we identify with that don't make us happy are those dark, dreadful, desolate, dreary thoughts of ego that tell us that we're separate from each other, we're separate from God, that we're doomed to a finite mortal existence, and life is tough and then you die, that kind of thinking. And you know, on the level of form, sure, you know, that seems to be the situation. But there's a level beyond that that this course asks us to look at. And, you know, again, it doesn't always work that way, but oftentimes, when we let go of our resistance to, looking at that desolate thought system and without judgment, without condemnation, and really release our valuation and our investment, we just kind of pull those identity ideas out of our mind's portfolio. Automatically comes in to take its place. We don't have, because it's already there. We don't have to, you know, add it. It's already there. But by doing the subtraction that you were talking about earlier of the stuff that doesn't work, we discover that there is a piece that's consistent and that we can draw from and that does work for us consistently and, you know, occasionally, maybe sometimes frequently, that reflects in things in the world that seem to go okay, but not always. I think it's because we all have such highly individualized curriculums that if we get attached to the outcome or the circumstances, which are merely and only reflections in a dream, then, you know, we're back to square one again. We're thinking that the world somehow is the cause and we're the effect, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. And on that note, we do need to wrap up the show. Oosh. And so I just want to say thank you so much. And Bruce will be back with me in the middle of July, the 3rd the third Friday, which I think is about the 21st, and where we will pick up and maybe move through the last three stages.
Meanwhile,
though, people, I really hope that you'll read this. I hope that you will, you know, start experiencing it, start doing that undoing and the sorting through, et cetera, and the relinquishing. So I hope you'll do that. And also, I'm going to post in the chat room, information for Bruce, which is www.acimblog.com. That's where you can reach him. Any other announcement before we go today, Bruce?
Not too many. Well, there is a, what comes to mind immediately is there is a conference that's basically, to help, honor and support the folks at, the Foundation for Inner Peace, that's happening in Utah. And, If you look on David Hoffmeister's site, that's happening there at their retreat center in July. I'm going there. I haven't decided yet. I think it's going to be pretty cool. Tamara Morgan and Bob Rosenthal, who are the new co-presidents of Foundation for Inner Peace, will be there, along with Gary and Cindy Bernard and David Hoffmeister and John Mundy and Carol Howe and a bunch of other folks. And so I think it's going to be a really cool event. So certainly the Foundation for Inner Peace, whose website is acim.org, and the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which is Ken Wapnick's organization, facim.org, are two, you know, sister organizations that certainly deserve our support and appreciation. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I will see you in July. And thanks to everybody who listened to the show today and to everybody who is in the chat room. Thanks for your comments and thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. And I hope that you'll stay tuned because there's more live programming coming up on 1-2 Radio. And so I guess that's it. So thanks for listening today, and you have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about developing trust in your life.